Good afternoon and welcome to the February meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you today from Erickson Hall at Point Lookout in Northport, Maine. And a particular welcome to our public radio audience reaching us through the good offices of Maine Public Broadcasting Network and their affiliate stations. I'm Tom DeMarco. I'm filling in for Mac DeFord, who is traveling. The forum is... It was founded in 1983. It's now celebrating, or now beginning its 31st year, 30-plus years of bringing you on a monthly basis informed speakers on all aspects of foreign affairs and U.S. Diplomatic policy, and often the lack thereof. Details about past and upcoming programs are available on our website at midcoastforum.org. The forum is very pleased today to be bringing you Paul Saunders, who is the executive director of this center, and by the way, the chief operating officer of the Center for the National Interest, and one of the publishers of that organization's magazine called The National Interest, published bimonthly by the Center for National Interest in Washington. He has a background of some service in government as well, serving in the Bush administration from 2003 to 2005. As a senior advisor to the Undersecretary of State for Global Affairs. He is an executive of the organization, but it also covers one of the study areas, which is Russia, and that's what he's going to be talking about today. We had some of the directors and Paul had dinner last night, and we peppered him with questions. The poor man, I'm sure, barely got to eat, and we came away uniformly convinced that there was no subtopic on the subject of Russia that he couldn't speak eloquently and cogently on. So welcome, Paul Saunders.
Thank you very much, Tom, and thank you to the forum for inviting me here. I've had already a delightful time, and I'm looking forward very much to the discussion this afternoon. I thought I would divide what I'm going to say into responses to five or six questions, and I'll talk predominantly about Russia, but Jim Allgrant suggested I also talk a little bit about what's happening in Ukraine right now, which has a lot to do with Russia and Russian foreign policy, so I'll weave that in as I get toward the end. The first question in terms of framing what I'd like to say is, you know, why does Russia do the things that it does in its foreign policy? And I think, you know, that's really for me one of the fundamental questions in our relationship with Russia. And as I thought about that, I came up with four broad reasons. I managed to think of words starting with S for each of them to try to make it a little bit easier to remember. So let me just go through those. Security, strength, sovereignty, stability. Security, you know, I think that's fairly straightforward. Every government is focused on its security. In Russia's particular case, I think there are two issues that rise to the top for them. One certainly is nuclear weapons. Obviously, Russia is one of the two largest nuclear powers in the world by far, like the United States. So they're very focused on nuclear weapons and also on American missile defense plans. The second big security issue for Russia is its immediate neighborhood. The countries on its borders, some of them being former Soviet countries, others like China, posing different kinds of challenges. And Russia, in looking at its borders, I think is predominantly wants to have friendly, stable neighbors to avoid risks like terrorism, drug trafficking, things like that. Strength, the second of the four S's, has multiple different components to it. One is economic strength, and I think the Russian government today recognizes very clearly that Russia cannot be the kind of power internationally that they want it to be without having a strong economy. There are a lot of challenges for Russia in getting there, but as you look at Russian foreign policy, you know, issues like trade, access to technology, energy exports, arms exports, many of those factor in. Another component of Russia's strength is its image, you know, looking like a strong country, both internally to the Russian population and internationally, looking like a major player in the system. Sovereignty, the third, you know, again, sovereignty is something that every government cares about and most people care about in the countries that they live in, but in Russia in particular, in the 1990s, the country was very weak after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and many people in Russia were really very upset about the way that the United States, Western countries, the IMF, were basically, from their point of view, telling their government what to do, telling their government which economic policies to pursue, limiting the Boris Yeltsin's kind of freedom to take decisions that he might otherwise have taken in foreign policy. So for many Russians, they really don't want to be in that situation again. They want to maintain clarity that they have a sovereign government that can take its own decision. And finally, stability. And stability, I think, is very straightforward. You can't have any of those other three things, security, strength, sovereignty, if you don't have a stable government. So some of Russia's foreign policy decisions are also driven in part by stability. Second question, is Russia inherently opposed to the United States? And, you know, I wish that that wasn't a question that I had to ask, but I think it's a question that's on many people's minds today. I think for many, you know, when you look around the world and you look at things that are happening in the world, it often seems like Russia is on the other side of almost every problem that the United States is trying to solve. You know, nevertheless, my answer to that question is no. You know, I don't think Russia, and I tried to choose my language carefully, I don't think Russia is inherently opposed to the United States. I think Russia certainly at times opposes the United States and aspects of American foreign policy. But I don't think it's inherently opposed. And you know, for me, there are really two reasons for that. The first is the way I see American and Russian national interests. And I think we are in a very different world today from the period of the Cold War, perhaps most importantly because American and Russian interests, American and Russian vital interests, vital national interests, are not in fundamental conflict. In the way that they were during the Cold War. And what do I mean by that? You know, vital interests are politicians frankly, our news media, whenever they want the American people to support something, it's always a vital interest. For me, the definition of a vital interest is considerably more strict than that. And what I mean by vital interest is something that's actually vital. You know, an interest that if it's compromised, it would threaten the survival or the nature of the country. And during the Cold War period, you know, there was a U.S.-Soviet rivalry. We were competing really with the goal of defeating the other country and potentially wiping it out. Khrushchev, of course, saying, we will bury you. We're not in that kind of competition today with Russia. It's not an existential competition that we have with Russia. We have some interests in common. We have some interests that come into conflict. So if you look at a situation like Iran, for example, I think the United States and Russia both have a common interest in Iran not having a nuclear weapon. You know, the problem is we have very different ideas about the best path to get to that point. That was particularly the case during the Bush administration. I think we're a little bit more on the same page now, but still not quite on the same page because for the United States, certainly for the Obama administration, there is a clear sense that it is pressure, the threat of military action, the threat of sanctions, that are the only way to bring Iran to the negotiating table, where Russian officials think that these kinds of threats are very counterproductive and back the Iranians into a corner and make it actually less likely that there would be a diplomatic solution. So it's an area, in that case, where we have common interests, but we don't necessarily have common approaches. There are other areas where we have different interests. And one area maybe that I would point to would be perhaps the former Soviet Union, you know, where the United States has been fairly deeply engaged during the post-Cold War period, less so in recent years than a few years ago, but has made it a matter of policy to support the independence of those countries. Russia, as I mentioned earlier, I think has accepted the independence of those countries, but wants them to be friendly to Russia. And when the United States takes approaches that are, you know, for example, supporting opposition groups because a country perhaps isn't sufficiently democratic, that comes into conflict with Russia's aims. But it's not a situation where our vital interests are in conflict. There may be, from Russia's perspective, vital Russian interests at stake, but from the perspective of most Americans, there are not vital American interests at stake, and I'll come back to that point a little bit later. The second thing that I would say, and the second reason that I think that Russia is not inherently opposed to the United States, is I view the Russian leadership as fundamentally pragmatic, not really ideological. President Putin is, I think, not a sentimental man, I guess is how I would put it. I think he's prepared to be quite practical in pursuing Russian foreign policy, and I think there's considerable evidence of that if you look at the history of the relationship. If people want to talk further about that in the questions, I'd be happy to do that. I would also call attention here to a couple of fundamental principles of psychology. When I was a graduate student in political science, my wife was a graduate student in psychology, so I learned a lot during that time period. And, there are a couple of very important psychological principles that I see as being at play in the U.S.-Russian relationship. I don't want to get too academic, but I think it's important to illustrate the point. One is the self-serving bias, and the other is the fundamental attribution error. These are the kind of academic psychology names. The self-serving bias is the kind of phenomenon that when you're trying to explain to yourself your own choices and decisions, you normally explain them in terms of the environment around you. Well, I had to do this because the circumstances forced me to. I was in this situation and I didn't have any other choice. I had to do that. The fundamental attribution error is a little bit the opposite. When you're trying to explain, when most people try to explain how other people behave, they tend to explain it in terms of that person's nature. He did that because he's a jerk. Rather than he did that because he's in a particular situation and it drives him down a particular path. And I think, for me, these are very important principles to keep in mind in thinking about international relations. I mean, they've been shown to have significant explanatory power in how people behave and think, and I think, you know, the international system is fundamentally composed of people. And my own view is that it would be helpful at times to put ourselves a little bit in the shoes of others and think about their constraints and situations. Certainly there are people who take a different view. I mean, this is really one of the fundamental debates in American foreign policy today. Why do people not like the United States? Is it because of who we are, or is it because of what we do? And that's a big, I think, for many, open question, though I certainly have my own views. Why is the U.S.-Russian relationship so tense? That's the next question that I'd like to try to address. And I'll try to do it fairly briefly, but I want to go through the last several years in the U.S.-Russian relationship and just try to lay it out a little bit. When Barack Obama was elected president at the end of 2008, I think the U.S.-Russian relationship was arguably at its lowest point since the end of the Cold War. Russia, many may remember, had invaded Georgia in August of 2008. The Bush administration responded to that by cutting off contact with Russia in a variety of different fora, and the rhetoric really became quite heated. When the Obama administration came into office, they tried to take take advantage of the opportunity of the change of administrations to develop a different relationship with Russia. And the first thing that the administration did coming in was to change the tone of U.S. statements about Russia, where the Bush administration by 2008 had become increasingly critical of Russia's domestic practices and foreign policy conduct. The Obama administration toned it down a little bit. The Obama administration also made it clear, they didn't make any kind of announcement or anything, but made it clear that the United States was not really going to press any longer for Ukraine and Georgia to become members of the NATO alliance. And they scrapped a plan that the Bush administration had to put in ground-based missile defense, anti-missile interceptors in Poland, and came up with a new and different missile defense plan, which at least initially the Russians felt more comfortable with, but over time that changed a little bit. For the first couple of years, the reset policy, as it came to be known, it worked reasonably well. There was important Russian cooperation in Afghanistan. We were talking about this a little bit beforehand. Russia allowing thousands of overflights of American transports carrying troops back and forth to Afghanistan. And then also on the ground, allowing the U.S. military to bring in tons and tons of equipment and supplies for the troops in Afghanistan. Nothing lethal, no arms, weapons, anything like that, but supplies. And it was very important to U.S. forces in Afghanistan. Now, we also had the New START Arms Control Treaty. There was something called a 123 agreement, which was for U.S.-Russian civilian cooperation in nuclear energy. And President Dmitry Medvedev, who was the president of Russia at that time, banned the sale of S-300 missiles, which were anti-aircraft missiles, to Iran. And this was something that the United States and also Israel were very keen to have happen. And it actually, since there was already a contract signed and Russia's arms manufacturer had actually taken the money, it became very controversial in the Russian relationship with Iran, and Iran actually has a lawsuit pending still against Russia trying to get that money back. After a couple of years, though, the reset really started to unwind. And I think there were three problems. One problem was the Obama administration created a perception in Russia that they were favoring Dmitry Medvedev, the Russian president, over Vladimir Putin. And I expect, left Putin with a little bit of heartburn. Secondly, the U.S. and Russia had managed to do a lot of the things that were, I don't want to say easy, because none of it was easy, but along the spectrum of what you would try to do in the U.S.-Russia relationship, those were the easier things. And a lot of the areas that were left were really very difficult. Further arms control, getting a real agreement on missile defense, moving farther on Iran, and really securing an outcome of Iran not having nuclear weapons. That was just very, very difficult. And there was also no real vision from either side about where the relationship should go, what it could look like in the future, what was the ultimate aim of the two sides. So, you know, in that environment, there were a lot of differences that started to emerge. The Obama administration got Russia and China to agree to let through a United Nations Security Council resolution on protecting civilians in Benghazi, in Libya. And then on the basis of that resolution, launched military attacks in Libya that the Russians and also the Chinese felt went far beyond what had been discussed at the United Nations. And this became a point of tension, actually, between Putin and Medvedev. Putin was criticizing Medvedev in the Russian press for agreeing to that and being taken advantage of. For a lot of Russians, it resonated with the way they felt Gorbachev had been basically played by the United States and the West at the end of the Cold War. Then in this environment, you know, we also had in Russia in 2011 Duma elections. The Duma is the lower house of the Russian parliament. And some may remember this was, I guess, about 2 years and a couple of months ago. It's December of 2011. that after those elections, there were some fairly widespread demonstrations in Russia. This was a couple of months after Putin had announced already that he was planning to run for president, and Medvedev had essentially said that he decided he really wanted to support Putin for president. And the United States kind of injected itself a little bit into that situation, as we often do, expressing our views about the Duma election, the outcome, the fairness, etc. Something that many Russians, and I expect also the Russian president, didn't particularly appreciate. And it was particularly challenging for Putin because his own election was just 3 months away. And he was very concerned with making sure that he would be able to leave the post of prime minister and become president again. And in the middle of that, in between the two elections, we sent a new ambassador to Moscow. Michael McFaul, a very talented Stanford academic who had worked actually on the National Security Council staff earlier in the administration, and I think by all accounts was very successful in helping the White House to move the reset agenda forward. The problem was that during his academic career, he had been a major scholar on democracy and democratization. And from the perspective of the Russian government, this was taking this expert on democracy and democratization, who has extensive personal relationships with much of the Russian opposition, and putting him in Moscow in this volatile political environment in between the two elections. That produced a lot of mutual recriminations. McFaul was being kind of harassed and shadowed by all kinds of different journalists and others supporting the Russian government. We had the differences over Syria really starting to emerge at the same time. The Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, and the then Ambassador to the United Nations, Susan Rice, both saying publicly that Russia had blood on its hands because of its role in Syria, which, you know, you can kind of argue about whether or not it's true that they have blood on their hands, but regardless of whether or not they have blood on their hands, for a Secretary of State or another senior American diplomat to say that in the press makes it very difficult to try to get further Russian help in dealing with that problem. So we had that. And, you know, throughout this whole period, concerns in the United States building about the domestic situation in Russia. You know, Putin coming back to power, concern about tighter controls over the media, concern about how the Russian government was handling opposition demonstrations, et cetera. So the relationship was kind of slowly spinning out of control, really culminating in, I guess it was about a year ago now, the passage in the U.S. Congress of the so-called Magnitsky Act. This is the, I think the full name is the Sergei Magnitsky Rule of Law and Accountability Act, and just very briefly, it related to the death in a Russian prison of Sergei Magnitsky, who was a lawyer for a Russian oligarch, Mikhail Khodorkovsky. Magnitsky died after being denied medical attention in prison, and this was viewed by the Congress as a serious human rights violation, and the Congress passed this legislation encouraging the State Department to deny visas or seize assets of any Russian officials or others who may have been involved in that, or anyone else who may have been involved in serious corruption or human rights violations in Russia. That provoked a very significant angry reaction from Russia. And then we got Edward Snowden. So, you know, that's basically where the relationship is now. It's tense. It's kind of crumbling a little bit. Without a clear plan for how to put it back together, I think, on either side. The only bright spot for people who want to see that relationship get back together, or at least on a more functional footing, recently was the agreement on getting rid of the Syrian chemical weapons, which did seem to suggest that it's still possible for the two sides to cooperate on important issues. But it's very tough. Now, I'll try to be very brief on Ukraine and then wrap up, because I talked a little bit longer than I wanted to about the history, but I wanted to lay it out there. You know, what has happened in Ukraine? Ukraine has been pursuing, or was pursuing since, I think, 2010, an association agreement with the European Union and also a trade agreement with the EU. And the negotiations had gone fairly far along, and I think the Europeans expected the Ukrainian government and the Ukrainian president, Viktor Yanukovych, to sign the agreement. But at the last minute, Yanukovych didn't. And he announced that, in fact, he wasn't going to sign the agreement. Partly because of pressure from Russia, and I think partly for some other reasons, which I'll get to in just a minute. This provoked inside Ukraine some fairly widespread demonstrations, especially in western Ukraine, where the sentiment for integrating into Europe is stronger. The Ukrainian government initially responded by cracking down on those protests, which made the situation worse. And then the government backed off a little bit from that. And we've had basically a tense standoff over the last several weeks. You know, I see myself basically two reasons why everything came apart in Ukraine. One is, and this connects to what I was saying a little bit earlier about the former Soviet region, there's a real asymmetry in interests between the European Union on one hand and Russia on the other. For Russia, Ukraine's future is possibly an existential issue. If it's not an existential issue, it's very close to being an existential issue. And for the Europeans, you know, it's something that they talk about a lot. They say it's very important. It has all the strategically significant consequences. But when push comes to shove, it's something that would be nice, but isn't really essential. You know, from a Russian perspective, this is one of their top three trading partners. It's a country of 45 million people right on their border. It sits on the route for pipelines that go from Russia to Europe carrying gas. It's in the position to control those pipelines. The taxes on Russia's natural gas exports are 5% of the Russian federal budget, not to mention the fate of Gazprom, which employs thousands and thousands of people. So for Russia, it was a really high-stakes situation. And the Russian government was prepared, on one hand, to make clear to the Ukrainian government that this is a serious situation and we're quite concerned, and if you do this, it will have this consequence and this consequence and this consequence. But the Russians were also prepared to say, but if you don't do this, if you decide not to do that, then we'll help you. The Russian government offered to buy $15 billion in Ukrainian debt at very low interest rates, given what Ukraine's sovereign debt rating is right now. That probably would have saved Ukraine a great deal in debt payments. And the Russian government and Gazprom also agreed to cut by one-third the price of Russian gas that goes into Ukraine. And Russia supplies two-thirds of Ukraine's natural gas. And cutting the price of two-thirds of the country's natural gas by a third, the Ukrainian energy minister said that would be $7 billion a year. The European Union, and they're in a difficult situation, obviously, after the euro crisis, and German taxpayers are tired of paying for everybody else's problems. But the European Union was not really in a situation where they were willing or able to offer assistance like that. They were essentially offering kind of a long-term promise, that if you do this, it'll have all of these great benefits for your economy. We'll have all this trade, and several years from now, things will be much better. So I think from the perspective of the Ukrainian leadership, the consequences of crossing Russia could have been fairly severe. Benefits of taking the Russian position were pretty clear and favorable, and the EU just wasn't there with anything. The second asymmetry, and I'll be a little bit briefer on this one, is an asymmetry in standards. The Russian government, in exchange for all of this money and assistance, basically wanted the Ukrainian government to be friendly, to join a Eurasian Economic Union that Putin is trying to put together. Not really to do a lot more than that. The European Union wanted the Ukrainian government to take all kinds of painful domestic economic reforms to bring its economy into conformity with EU standards, and also to do some political things, to bring Ukraine's political system into a little closer conformity with European standards. And one of the most significant things there was to release from prison Yulia Tymoshenko, who had been previously prime minister of Ukraine, was basically put in prison by Yanukovych. I mean, there was a trial, but it was it did not meet the highest standards of justice. The Europeans wanted her to be let out and to be allowed to compete politically in Ukraine without being hindered by the Ukrainian government. So from the perspective of Yanukovych, the Europeans wanted him simultaneously to introduce a lot of economic policies that were going to be painful and unpopular, and to release from prison his principal political opponent. Into an environment that would be very favorable for her politically, When there's a presidential election in Ukraine in, I think, about 15 months from now or something like that. When, you know, if she or others in the opposition won, they would be the ones who would enjoy all of the benefits of working with the EU, because, you know, it would take 2 or 3 years for these policies to start to turn the economy around. So it's a very difficult situation for the Ukrainian government, I think, not too surprising that they went the way they did. Looking ahead, and here I'll try to be even briefer, you know, in Ukraine, I think Yanukovych is basically trying to sit still and hope that the protests go away. He doesn't have a lot of other good options. He may get lucky, and the protests might die out. He might not get lucky, and if that happens, he's going to have to make some tough choices. In the U.S.-Russia relationship, I think we are still really hampered by this lack of a vision in either country of where the relationship can go. And I think it's particularly important because, you know, in the early stages of the reset, there was really a lot of optimism about where the relationship could go. And that optimism, you know, it gives you hope. I think it gave both sides hope that there were all kinds of different possibilities, and, you know, they could give a little bit here or there in the reasonable expectation that they might get something else down the line. When you take that hope away, and I think it has really evaporated now, it becomes a very transactional relationship. You know, working together narrowly on individual specific items, but no overarching view. I think that's really, unfortunately, where we are now. The very last thing I would say, in thinking about a vision for the relationship and our strategic goals for the relationship, you know, as I look at the international system today, I see a system where the United States is an international leader. It's enormously to our advantage to be an international leader. And we, together with the Europeans, in the aftermath of World War II, were able to define a whole network of international institutions, the UN Security Council, the World Bank, the IMF, all of these other organizations and processes. In a way that works in our favor and helps us to sustain our leadership. Not everybody on the planet is excited about that state of affairs. But I think it's in our interest to try to preserve that. So how do you try to preserve that? Well, from my point of view, the first step in trying to preserve that is avoiding a situation where the governments that don't like the current situation are driven into cooperation to try to undermine it. And I have in mind specifically China and Russia. China and Russia are both dissatisfied in different ways with the international system today and with things that the United States does. Individually, I don't think that either of them would be in a position to overturn or significantly change the system that we're living in now. Working together, the two of them could be very disruptive. I think that's something that we need to think very, very carefully about in the years ahead as we formulate our policy towards both Russia and China. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Paul. Since you alluded to Russia and China, in a recent paper, you dropped the following factoid, that between 1980 and the present, Russia and China have effectively switched places in the world economy. Russia was 9% of the global domestic economy in 1980 and is now 2%, and China was 2% in 1980 and is now 9%. How did this happen?
Well, it happened in a couple of different ways. I mean, certainly one important way was that the Soviet Union collapsed, and the Russian economy was only ever a part of the Soviet economy. It wasn't the whole thing. And after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Russian economy collapsed. So those two things combined, I think, drove down Russia's share fairly significantly. As far as China is concerned, you know, I think we have all been watching that in kind of a combination of shock and awe, I guess. I mean, it's really quite remarkable the way that economy has grown over the last 30 years. Personally, I think it's an open question how long that's really sustainable. That's another whole set of issues, and probably one where you want to have a China expert come and talk.
But it's not just China, it's growth, it's also Russia's decline in some sense.
That's right. Although over the last 10 years, Russia has done much better as oil prices in particular rebounded during the first decade of the 21st century.
Is there something in the Russian psyche that predisposes Russians to want to be ruled by a czar? Does that help explain Putin's persona?
Well, you know, I hate to make those kinds of generalizations, but, you know, Russia has had a very particular history. And I think it is a history that has taught many Russians that domestic instability in the country is very costly and dangerous. Certainly the Russian Revolution in 1917, but also even further back than that, at the times when the Russian leadership was weak and there was instability in the country, it led to violence, conflict, and death. So I think there is this kind of historical memory of those circumstances, and it pushes people in the direction of having a strong leader.
Yeah, one thing that seems to have come in under the American radar is this rapprochement between Putin and the Romanov heirs. Could you say a word about that?
Well, I think that is really an effort by Putin to try to, on one hand, reclaim some of Russian history. And he is, like many in Russia, proud of the country's imperial history. And on the other hand, to try to contribute to the legitimacy of the current system by tying it a little bit to that pre-revolutionary government.
Do you see a chance of cooperation on North Korea, both nuclear and human rights?
On North Korea, that's another case with Russia where I think we have broadly similar interests. You know, Russia doesn't want North Korea to have a nuclear weapon. Of course, North Korea, unlike Iran, already does. So there is a degree of commonality there. I think the challenge, again, is that the Russian government has different ideas about how you get the North Koreans to agree. And also, more broadly, the Russian government has very substantially deferred to Beijing in dealing with North Korea. North Korea is... it's not quite a client of China because the North Korean leadership is a little bit too independent for that. But North Korea is quite dependent on China, And I think the Russians recognize that and don't really want to inject themselves into the relationship between Beijing and Pyongyang because it would irritate the Chinese, and they're not likely to have that much influence anyway.
Well, on a similar line, I have a bunch of questions here about Syria. Will the Russian leadership ever stop its backing for Assad in Syria? If so, under what circumstances?
Well, you know, the Russian involvement in Syria is very complex. I don't think the Russians particularly like Assad. And actually, I have been in meetings with senior Russian officials who have referred very disparagingly to Assad, you know, calling him a butcher, calling him someone who is trying to sustain a family dynasty, which there's clearly kind of a negative connotation to that. I don't think they particularly like Assad. I think the problem is, and this connects a little bit to the point about stability and also to Russian foreign policy more broadly, the Russian government is most of all afraid of the Islamic extremists in Syria. And they are prepared to accept an Assad government if it can keep the extremists under control or kill them all, actually, for that matter. I mean, they'd be perfectly satisfied with that, too. It's less, I think, about supporting or endorsing Assad than it is about avoiding a worse alternative. And they are not at all persuaded that the more moderate elements of the Syrian opposition are sufficiently popular and powerful to be able to control the country if Assad falls. So their nightmare is that Assad falls and there is not really a stable government and a strong government that can follow, and it just becomes anarchy. And that leads them into the position of supporting Assad as kind of the best among a bunch of bad choices.
Is there a way for us to play that? For instance, if we finally decided that we could live with Assad, would that make a good 1-2 punch, the Russians plus ourselves?
Well, certainly if we decided that we could live with Assad, which would be a major break with everything that the Obama administration has said so far, yes, that would allow us to cooperate. I think, another direction that we could go in that allows us to cooperate is for us to stop publicly insisting that Assad goes. And I think there are a number of people in Russia and in the Russian government who don't see Assad, who see Assad already as damaged and weakened. And I don't think they see Assad's rule at this point as indefinitely sustainable. So if we could get into a place where we both support reconciliation inside Syria, and Assad's departure isn't a precondition of that, but might end up happening anyway through the natural course of events, that's another option.
Brzezinski, in a recent book, talks of a future with Russia, the U.S. working closely together as a balance to the East. Is this still possible? Is Russia likely to develop closer ties with the West?
Sure. I was edging a little bit in that direction toward the end of my remarks, but I want to be very clear about what I was saying and what I wasn't saying. Actually, I think it's very unlikely that there would be any kind of alliance or explicit cooperation between the United States and Europe and Russia in dealing with China. And the reason is China is right on the Russian border. Its economy is 3 or 4 times the size at this point of the Russian economy. China has a massive military. I don't think that Russia and the Russian government would put their country in the position of openly confronting China. From my point of view, the real issue is how much flexibility does Russia have in its relationship with China? And in a situation where Russia feels simultaneously threatened from the West and from the East, and you know whether they should feel threatened from the West, you know, we can have a debate about that, but they do. In that situation, it gives them many fewer options in dealing with China and makes it much more tempting for them to support China, to work with China, to cooperate with China. If we could get to a place where we had a security architecture in Europe that gave Russia a role that it was satisfied with, that also, of course, satisfied us and the Europeans, and they felt more secure, then I think they would have much more flexibility in how they deal with Beijing. Not again, because I don't think they would oppose China, but they would have much more flexibility.
Yeah, you make it seem like kind of a long shot, though, that try.
Well, I think it's theoretically possible, I think we have to think long and hard about that. We have to think long and hard about what kind of relationship we want to have with China also. There are a lot of different directions that can go. It will not be easy.
As you can see, we have dozens of questions that we're not going to get to. I want to group three of them together. There are three questions about Putin's successor. Russia, since the revolution, has not had a great history of successful successions. What do you see in a post-Putin world?
Well, that's going to be probably a ways off. The Russian Constitution was amended so that presidents have a 6-year term. So Putin's current term doesn't end until 2018. He could theoretically run again and might be reelected. So he could be in power actually until 2024 without making any changes to the Constitution. Who knows what kind of a country Russia will be by 2024. I guess the most I can say about that, since it's so far in the future, is, I think the center of gravity in the Russian political system is still a little bit left of center and rather nationalistic. Something happened suddenly and Putin was just dramatically taken out of the equation and there was a scramble for power, I think that's the most likely kind of leader we would end up with. That said, 2024 is a long way away. There are a lot of things that could happen inside the country between now and then. Certainly, so far, the Russian middle class has been getting bigger. Many people in the middle class are less satisfied with the past bargain that they had with Putin, which was, you provide economic growth and we leave you alone, basically. So There is, I guess, some scope for hope that the center of gravity may move, but we'll see.
Well, we know that great speakers like Paul who come and address the Midcoast Forum don't come for the main weather, in the winter at least, and they don't come for the modest honorarium we give them. So, Paul, we know you've come for the cup. So it's a great pleasure to award you the Midcoast Forum Cup.
Oh, that's great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.